Thank you, Nala, so much for this amazing introduction. And I have to ask you to excuse me for my appearance. My luggage was lost, and this is how I came yesterday. And I didn't have the chance to even change or anything. So I usually take these things very serious, but I didn't have the chance to do that, unfortunately. Thank you, Nahla, and thank you, Marie-Yves, and for the invitation, and for the sociology department and all the co-sponsors. I'm very glad to be in Canada for the first time, which is interesting because I was telling Nahla that I've been all over the world, and the only two places that I didn't go were Mexico and Canada, the closest to us. So, this is part of a project that I'm working on, actually. It's called The Long Arab 19th Century. And the idea came after the Arab Spring. And essentially, I will clarify the meaning of this concept as we go on. But I usually would like to start with the idea that Nahla just mentioned about the idea of misinformation. And that is essentially where I usually start most of my lectures. My main argument is essentially this. All the existing accounts on the history of the Middle East and the history of the Arab region do not explain the political present. So we have a narrative, we have an account of the Middle Eastern history, of Middle Eastern politics, of the Arab people, of the Muslim people in the region, but that doesn't explain the political present. The succession of past, present, and future doesn't seem actually to make sense. So the only way to explain the current or the political present is to go back and to rewrite and reconstruct the history of the Arab region in order to make sense of the political present. How did we come to this point? All the existing explanations don't actually make sense in that regard. And when I started doing that, I found out that some of the most current and recent incidents that we're seeing in the Middle East and events, all the accounts, existing accounts, go back 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, 15 years to explain them. And when I started this massive project of reconstructing the Arab history, rewriting the Arab history, I found out that some of these current events, like the Syrian refugee question, like the Palestinian Nakba, the rise of ISIS, which I will talk about it a little bit, because I think it's important given the events in Paris recently and in Beirut, that in some of these events have their seeds hundreds of years ago. So we have to go back at least 200 years in time to be able to explain events that are taking place currently. And I'm very used to that, actually, because one of my areas of expertise is environmental sociology. And in environmental sociology, we make the argument, basically, that we have to go back 200 million years to the breakup of the Pangaea, to the supercontinent, into the current, you know, structure of the world, to be able to explain the environmental conditions of the world and the reason of success and failure of certain, say, colonial attempts, why they succeeded in North America and they failed in Africa, you know, because of the similarities between Europe and North America. Essentially, that 200 million year old process located North America and Africa in their current positions where and enabled the Europeans to immigrate or settle in successfully in North America, but failing to settle in Africa the way they did. So we'll start with the misinformation part. This is the cover page of an interesting book. It's called Society of the Spectacle by Guy Debord. And the cover page essentially, this is another one, actually, comes from a photograph that was taken by Life magazine, actually a series of photographs were taken by Life magazine, and it was at the Paramount Theater, Oakland, California, November 26, 1952. That was the first screening ever of the first 3D movie. And this is a very significant event that sociologists kind of use it as an indicator that this is when we started seeing a significant and a radical change in social relations. Essentially, when you look at the series of pictures, you will see a uniform reaction by all the audience. This is where the power of the media can be seen, that the French philosopher later, Jean Baudrillard, would come and characterize that as the death of the real. That reality is dead, and media creates a parallel reality, a simulation, and this is what we're presented with. So this is a very significant event. The uniformity of reaction by the audience in 1952 for the first 3D TV was significant to social scientists, to the role of the media. Jean Baudrillard would come 10 years later with a series of articles, and I like to talk about that for a minute. Before the Gulf War started in 1991, he wrote his famous article, "The Gulf War Will Not Take Place." That was January 4, 1991. During the war, February 6, 1991, he wrote his second article, "The Gulf War, Is It Really Taking Place?" That was during the war. After the war, he wrote his third piece, which were the title for the book later, "The Gulf War Did Not Take Place." That was March 29. And of course, we all witnessed an event, a massive event, that we thought it is war. What Baudrillard says basically is simply that to characterize that as a war between the whole world, mainly the US and Iraq, is a misnomer at best. What happened was an atrocity, the destruction of a 7,000-year-old civilization by a very powerful country, essentially. And so to characterize it as war is to give it legitimacy. But that wasn't the main point. The main point was what we witnessed on TV, live broadcast, for the first time. The first war to be broadcasted live was the Gulf War in 1991, was the most misunderstood war. Because what we were exposed to is a stylized information, a simulation of reality. Not the actual war, but a stylized propaganda of images and videos. As such, the war, what we saw in the media, wasn't really the actual war that was taking place on the ground. And that actually takes us to a media campaign that preceded actually the Gulf War and prepared for it. Edward Said later in Culture and Imperialism would actually use an interesting statement that this media activism and activity and role was preparing what was, of course, reflected the sorry state of power and knowledge. That in order for Iraq or for the US and the rest of the coalition to destroy Iraq, they had to make Iraq a nation without roots. A 7,000-year-old civilization was essentially called a country that has no culture. And interestingly, the writer was an Arab person who used to teach at Johns Hopkins. He's dead now.
Fuad Ajami.
Fuad Ajami, yes. So it was one of thousands of articles and studies that essentially transformed Iraq from the most fertile country in the Middle East into a dry area and a border country between what he called the Arab Peninsula and Persia. So what we see in the media, that's why it's very fascinating and significant. Why I like to do this when I talk about the Middle East, why I like to do this when I talk about Palestine in particular, because in one of my papers, I was actually doing a survey about the Western writings on Palestine. And I found out that Palestine, a very small country, by the way, one of actually the second smallest country in the whole region after Bahrain, has more publications, more scholarship, more op-ed pieces, more documentaries than any other country in the whole region. Excepting for Egypt, which is a huge country and has a long history, Palestine comes second and has more than any other country in the region. Interestingly enough, the Palestinian question is the most misunderstood question in the West. The more you read about Palestine in the West, the less you know. It's the Gulf War did not take place. The same thing. So that's why really scholarship is significant. We need to avoid those 3D glasses to be able to actually see reality. And that is a very serious challenge to scholars all over the world, especially those Middle East scholars in particular and Arabists in the West. So here we go. That's with that, what you hear in the media isn't something similar to what actually is happening and the terms that are imposed on us. So in order to understand the Middle East, as I said, we really need to go back at least 200 years in time. And I will show you a simple question, a few questions, when I talk about ISIS. And I think I will start with ISIS, not with Palestine this time because of the moment. And what I characterize as the long 19th century is essentially an epoch that began in 1811, an Arab attempt to actually enter history. And when we say enter history, essentially we mean the formation of a nation, the formation of the Arab nationhood, and by implication, the formation of nation state. From 1811 until today, all the Arab attempts have been to achieve this purpose. But given the sequence of wars actually, of encroachment on the Arab world, this epoch seems to be or to constitute a rupture in the Arab history. What does that mean? In 1948, let me just take you, I'm going to skip just to give you that meaning to this. What do we mean by rupture in history and the breakup of this succession, past, present, and future? When we talk about the Nakba of Palestine, in 1948, Israel was founded on the Palestinian land. And Edward Said commented on this, saying that to say that the 1948 made an extraordinary cultural and historical demand on the Arab people is really to be guilty of the crassest understatement. Why? Because of the challenges the Nakba put on the Arab people. It took place exactly in 1948. And if you look at 1948, you see between 1945 and 1948, up to 1950, most world nations gained their independence at that time and formed their nationhood, their master narratives, and their nation states. The Arab people, this event constituted or caused a rift between the Arabs and the very possibility of their existence. The Arabs were the only nation in the world that were not allowed at that particular moment to form their nationhood, establish their nation states, and actually enter history, as I said, and enter politics. The formation of Israel divided the Arab homeland mainly, and they learned the lesson from the Crusaders back in the 11th and the 12th century, why the Crusaders failed essentially because they did not control all Palestine and left a corridor between Egypt and Syria. So the separation of Egypt and Syria literally means geographically and in terms of geopolitics, controlling the whole Arab world. That's why the centrality of the colonizing Palestine was significant. So, The Arabs were not able to, unlike all other nations, were unable to form their nationhood, unable to establish their nation state, and they experienced this rupture. They cannot go back to history, direct or colonization, classical colonization, and they cannot move forward to the future because their present is interrupted. They cannot form their nationhood, unlike any other nation. This is a very significant challenge that no other nation on earth faced. Second, so when we see the Arab reaction, especially some of the distorted reaction to this reality, people should consider this. Add to this significant challenge, the Arabs had to deal with Europe's most significant problem that Europe created for centuries and couldn't solve, the Jewish question. So they moved it to Palestine, to the Middle East, to the Arab region. So Europe's most significant, so the Arabs had to deal with these two significant and major challenges. We cannot understand anything. This succession that was interrupted, we cannot understand anything about Arab politics, Arab present, if we miss this specific historical event. So every event that is taking place at this point in the Arab world must be connected to 1948. Any failure, any movement, any action in the Arab world is related to this. Essentially dividing the Arab world the way the West did in 1916, actually in preparation or in the run-up for the establishment of Israel, divided the Arab world, denied the Arabs forming their nationhood, but also form a cultural unity. And that's why Arabs struggle in this sense, not only against Israel, but in the face of the West, is existential. Existential in the sense that if the Arabs fail to protect and maintain their culture, and we don't have a reality to do that, a unified reality, your whole existence as a nation is threatened. So when the Arabs say this is an existential threat, they are really correct about it because their very cultural existence is threatened. And any nation without a cultural existence doesn't really exist. So, but we actually need to go even further than this to understand the context and the conditions in the Arab world. The second major one is what I will call de-development. Actually, it's a term that I borrow from a Lebanese researcher, economist, who is working on a similar project, essentially rewriting the economic history of the Arabs, or the Arab world, or the Arab region. In order, what I do is I'm trying to rewrite the social history and rewrite the political history. What he says basically that the Arab world has been or underwent a process of purposeful deconstruction of its potential to transform economically, essentially, and achieve development. Actually, what has been happening in the Arab world since 1811 is a process of purposeful and forceful reverse development. He calls it de-development. Essentially, if you want to understand the Syrian refugee question, you can start with 5 years ago, or 5 years ago, and with the events, the crisis in Syria. But the events in Syria and the crisis in Syria could explain to us the current refugee question and the flood of refugees going to Europe at this point. But this is not really something new in Syria, in Palestine, or in the whole Arab region. People have been migrating in waves, actually, for the last 200 years. So this is not something new. When we look at the numbers, what we see is that, yes, the numbers are actually skyrocketing now, but there has always been a trend. And the trend can be traced back to an international economic policy. We call it neoliberalism today, That actually led to the de-development of the Arab economy, and essentially created this refugee question. So we cannot blame only the current events in the Middle East for this crisis. But I can tell you, I did not really start yet. Nahla tells me that I talk too much.
I didn't tell you that.
I'm going to start with ISIS. I will show you why we need to go back in history for at least 200 years. One time I went crazier and I made the argument that we should go back to 1450. Otherwise, we won't be able to understand ISIS. Why 1450? One of the most interesting, actually, American sociologists is a guy called Emmanuel Wallerstein, and I think some of you might be familiar with the name. Mm-hmm. And Wallerstein once posed a very interesting question, actually two questions. Well, and he says, why couldn't the 19th century success of liberalism in Europe, essentially the formation of the welfare state and elections or liberal democracy, why couldn't these successes be replicated in the rest of the world? Now, when you hear the question is usually that we hear all the time is, why can't Islamic societies or Arab societies be democratic? Wallerstein is actually smarter than that, because the first question indicates or imply the answer that the problem is in Islam or the problem is in the Arab culture. He asked the question generally, not only in the Islamic world or the Arab world. The whole third world or south is not democratic, really. Of course, there are some exceptions. But it's not also democratic in the liberal sense, and we don't have a welfare state. Why? Why couldn't they do that, like Europe in the 20th century? He provides a very interesting answer. He says, there is no third world for the third world. Essentially saying that Europe did not develop independently. Europe did not achieve, and by Europe I mean Europe and near Europe. And near Europe, essentially, areas of where Europeans settled and established a European home. Kind of like Canada. US, you know, Australia, New Zealand. So they did not develop independently, and they did not pay for these reforms on their own. They had to exploit the third world to be able to achieve these great reforms. One simple example, just look at the American budget, the US budget. Every year there is a deficit of about $1 trillion. So the US government has to provide about $3 to $5 billion daily so the American people would live the way they do. They never tell us where they get this money from, right? But then we essentially have a problem with the world order, a world order that was established or began to be formed in 1450 that is Eurocentric or biased, essentially, and is designed for the transfer of surplus and economic resources directly and indirectly from the south to the north. I'm sure we're all familiar with like those theories of core, periphery, metropole, satellite, you know, relations in which economic surplus is transformed from the south to the north. So there is a problem with the world order that no one is actually addressing, essentially, that this is where one major source of almost all problems, that this is a Eurocentric world order designed from the beginning to benefit Europe and later near Europe so they can live the way they do. In other words, if there was no south for the south, then the south cannot achieve what the north achieved. And in order for the North to be democratic, in order for the North to have welfare state, the South must be the way it is. So it is not that Islam is against democracy or Islamic culture is incompatible with democracy. It's not that any South culture, Africa or anywhere else, is incompatible with democracy. It is the structure of the world order. That is at the level of the structure of the world order, the actual structure. Now let's go to the ideology, because that order, that structure requires some sort of justification, right? And Wallerstein kind of indicates such a question, but actually this is a question that is posed by the third world nationalists for a long time and by intellectuals from the South. And it goes like this. Why couldn't the European Enlightenment, the ideas of liberation, revolution, modernization, prevent Europe from colonizing two-thirds of the world population and actually enslaving a significant part of the world population? Why couldn't these great ideas do that? I don't have an answer for that. I have actually a comment that comes from third world scholars or South scholars who say, actually, we can go actually a step further. We don't want to sound mean, but we think that even these ideas are Eurocentric ideas, and the question should be, or the proper question which should be, how did, or and how does these ideas contribute, or contributed, to the colonization of two-thirds of the world and the enslaving a large number of the people of the South? So these ideas, not only the ideas of modernity, not only are Eurocentric, but possibly they might have contributed to what Europe have done. It's not a matter of hypocrisy. So we have a problem with the third world, with the world order. And the problem with the world order is not something new. The world doesn't listen. Intellectuals in the West are concerned about the West problems in the West. But the intellectuals in the third world, in the South, have always actually pointed out to the Eurocentric nature of the world order as a major source of most world troubles. One of them is the poet Aimé Césaire, who was an African, lived in France, and became, of course, was a citizen, and was a famous member of the French Communist Party. And I like to say French Communist Party because it's as radical as you could get, right? And he eventually resigned even from the French Communist Party. In the late 1920s, he was in France in a college student. And his friend was Leopold Senghor, who became the president of Senegal later. And in their discussion, he asked a famous question that became the foundation of what we know today as the third worldism or third world nationalism. And he asked, who are we in this white world? Essentially, we're very famous. He is a very famous man. Very famous. One of the most amazing poets in the world, really. He's French. He was a citizen, but he was not treated as French or as a citizen. So if we ask this question now to the French, we will be able to understand some of the events in France. And I want to make a distinction here. Because we scholars have a problem, because when people ask us a question, we try to explain. That's what we're trained to do. And there is a big difference between explanation and justification. We don't justify events. Actually, anybody would condemn things like that. But there is always a rational explanation for why phenomena like that exist, why events like that happen. That's why, actually, we have universities. the basic idea of universities is to acquire this sort of knowledge. So he was asking this question in France. It's the same question that people in the suburbs of Paris ask these days, that they don't feel not only fully French, they feel so much discrimination against them. It is not accident that some of the troubles in Syria, a major part of the troubles in Syria, all those fanatics in Syria doing unimaginable acts are not from the region. They were born and raised in Europe, particularly in France. So if you want to understand that event, you have to question their background in France, their conditions in France first. Because even the people of the region can't believe what they can do and what they are doing. But to lead to that, and that's why I'm saying it's a question that has always existed. Senghor and Césaire did not answer the question. They just posed it. The answer came, interestingly, from another three Africans this time, sisters, called the Nardal sisters. And the Nardal sisters, all my notes are in the bag. So the Nardal sisters proposed a very interesting idea that was in the early 30s. It's called black internationalism. And black internationalism doesn't, of course, mean internationalism or a world order for the blacks or Afro-centered world order. It essentially means we need an alternative world order that recognizes the existence of the non-Europeans and incorporate them and their interests in this world order. We need a more just world order. Interestingly, as I said, this answer came from three sisters. So the contribution of women to these ideas is very significant and very important, more than anyone can imagine. Actually, probably they were smarter than the first two, because the first two asked the question, and the Nardal sister, one of them is actually an amazingly smart person. Her name is Jane. She was the one actually who proposed this idea. So the search for alternatives, essentially, to the current world order has been there for a very long time. The recognition that the source of problems and troubles all over the world can be traced back to this world order is not a new idea. So unless we ignore it, we cannot really deal with any of the issues that are actually taking place in the world. Now, what existed is a model, or promoted, a Western-oriented model, and is proposed as the way to success, to succeed, and the course of economic development. The people of the South did try that. It failed. They tried other options. It failed. Because the serious question, the serious issue, the structural issue was not addressed. Comes ISIS. ISIS, let me state that clearly at the beginning. ISIS is a dead-ended venture. It's not going to disappear tomorrow or next year. But it's a dead-ended venture. Their ideologies and their worldviews doesn't provide any answer for the Arab problems at all. But there is something about this we should understand related to the world order, because all other attempts to achieve economic development in the world, in the South, were fought furiously, but was attacked by the West more than they are attacking ISIS now. Because they realize ISIS is a dead-ended venture. But we had an example in 1952 in Egypt, President Nasser, who literally achieved a significant revolution in Egypt. And he came to power in 1952. By 1956, they were calling him the Hitler of the Nile. He was the guy who was demonized the most in the West. Why? Look at the economic, political, social indicators in the 18 years he was president. The lives of the Egyptians improved significantly, but the improvement of the lives of the Egyptians in every aspect of life means less surplus will be transformed to the West to support and finance the welfare state and the liberal democracy. So there were attempts to do that, alternatives to do that. But before I actually go to the meaning of ISIS, and the question that I usually deal with is why ISIS, not what ISIS? Most scholars are actually consumed with what ISIS. They're trying to understand the ideology, membership, leadership, hierarchy. And that's important, by the way. I'm not saying it's not important. But nobody asked the question, why do we have such a phenomenon in the 21st century? It doesn't belong. Why do we have such a phenomenon in the 21st century? And they don't really address these questions from the point of view of this different framework, the world order. Before I go to the meaning, this is what one of the most probably important historians of our time, Eric Hobsbawm, he has a fascinating 3-volume work on the history of Europe and the European revolutions. In the first volume, he writes this. Words are witnesses, he says, which often speak louder than documents. So the great revolutions of 1789 to 1884 in Europe was the triumph not of industry as such, but capitalist industry. Not liberty and equality in general, but a victory for the values and ideas of the middle class, or the bourgeois liberal society. Not modern economy, but the modern state and the economies of certain states in certain regions in the world, mainly North America and Western Europe. And that actually means basically that when we say industry, we don't have to say capitalist industry. We think there is, you know, one type of industry and it's the one we have. And he says, no, all the words, all the English terms that were invented at that time gained meaning as a result of the events that were taking place. And all the other words that were invented also gained meaning at that time. So liberal democracy sounds very normal. Caliphate sounds weird, right? Sharia law, Sharia law, Sharia law. 3 times on Fox News, say Sharia law, people would really run away. So if the domination of the West is not only domination in terms of like economic domination, or what we call economic imperialism, and also cultural imperialism, but also in terms of idioms as well. That's how you rule the world. But let me tell you a short story about liberal democracy, because it was actually the tool by which the Arab uprisings were hijacked. In 1871, or before 1871, the history of the revolutions in Europe. Hobsbawm's history says there were 2 revolutions taking place at the same time. The social revolution in France, which entailed a certain kind of popular democracy, social democracy, if you like, and the industrial revolution in England. At the beginning, the social revolution was advancing at a faster rate, and the bourgeoisie and the feudal lords were actually scared. Later, the Industrial Revolution, he says, advanced so much that it swallowed the Social Revolution. What happened to that? Before 1871, the European bourgeoisie used to fear democracy, because to them, democracy was a recipe for socialism. Give people the choice, they will choose all the good things. Yeah, socialism is good. Now, after 1871, when they butchered the workers in Paris, in the Paris Commune, they realized that democracy could be a tool not only of taming the population, because you're choosing your leadership, and that's why really revolutions don't happen in the West. They happen only in the South, because taming is part of the process. Foucault would be very helpful to explain this. But also, it could be a trick, a magic formula to reproduce the system. Transfer of power within the elite. It doesn't matter who rules, as long as the rule is a class-based rule. They discovered this trick after 1871. They started applying it. What Hobsbawm says is that when they discovered this trick, they found out that the Americans have been doing it for a long time. The Americans managed to combine democracy and slavery. Amazing, right? Democracy and racism, democracy and sexism. And later, in the 21st century, democracy and rendition, democracy and torture. So it's a trick in some sort. Now, comes the Arab Spring, they tried to actually market this same idea. The point was, from day one in the Arab world, the revolution was, or revolutions were about socio-economic demands, improving the living conditions of the people. And then we started seeing a redefinition, and by implication, a reorientation of the event, because who defines the event determines its course. And they defined the event, first in the Western media, as democracy movement, and they introduced the term democratic transition. And democratic transition essentially is a period of time given to the elite in the Arab world to reproduce itself so it can win via democracy. But in addition to all that, in the Arab world, and that's the process of de-development that led to the refugee questions, that led to Arab refugees all over the world, essentially, entailed in the last 30 years, all the indicators in terms of poverty rate, unemployment, labor growth, every economic indicator shows that the situation has been actually deteriorating more and more significantly in the last 30 years. Last 30 years because it's associated with the introduction of neoliberalism into the Arab world. And with the introduction of packages, very radical packages, actually, of neoliberalism to the Arab world, all significant decision-making in the Arab world have been actually sent or relocated to the outside. The most important decisions related to the lives of the Arab people are in the hands of the World Bank and the IMF. That essentially means democracy is a joke. You're actually voting for who is going to implement the rules of the World Bank and the IMF. You're not voting for somebody who is going to achieve national independence here and social equality. So we have to be very careful with the words. So what he said here is exactly what Guy Debord said in the Society of the Spectacle that we began with, all these pictures, and what John Baudrillard said in the Gulf War did not take place. So what is the caliphate? For people who are not aware with the idiom, are not familiar with the idiom, it sounds really weird, and it is understandable. But as a sociologist, when I hear the term caliphate, and because if you know anything about the Islamic history and Arab history, the caliph wasn't really a scholar of Islam or a scholar of religion, historically. Actually, they were some of the most un-Islamic people who were caliphs, and violated every single Islamic rule. But the term caliphate basically means that Muslims realize that the problems confronting the Arabs and the Muslims, the Arab world and the Muslim world, are political. Because the caliphate is just another political model. Let me reaffirm what I said at the beginning. ISIS is a dead-ended venture. They don't provide any solution for all these problems. But that is really what the idea of caliphate means. That some people in the Islamic world think that because of this Eurocentric world order, all the models that we adopted from certain types of socialism to neoliberal economics to Western-oriented models failed. So we need a political solution for the problems that are confronting us, the social and the economic. Thus, the caliphate. But the caliphate seems weird as an idiom because it comes from a different language. But really, in that sense, it's a metaphor for the struggle between Muslims, Muslim aspirations, to reorder the post-colonial world. Essentially, it's a protest against this world order. It's the wrong way, but it signifies that there is a serious fault in the world order. Simple example I give to my students in class, that if I'm facing an economic problems, I would do one of two things. I would talk to people who are like me. We can protest, we can strike, we can do all sorts of supposedly rational ways to deal with this condition. Or I could go and steal. In sociological terms, both are forms of class struggle, really. The first one is the proper one. The second one, we call it distorted form of class struggle. That's ISIS. It's the wrong answer, but it doesn't negate that there is a bad situation there. Now, we can talk about their practices, their savage practices, their really, they're actually also crazy views, if you like. But that's why when you propose a military solution to such a phenomenon, invade the country and destroy it over their heads, you're not actually killing the seed, which will bring us, and people who don't know, Al-Qaeda is a very terrible organization. Very bad.
Created by the U.S.
It is nothing compared to ISIS. Nothing. And the next generation of that line will be even much more dangerous than these ones, unless somebody addresses this question that brings them there. So it's a problem of decolonization. Essentially, this is what we have, is there is something that sociologists and historians call the anti-colonial imagination. We Palestinians had some of that before. And the anti-colonial imagination, essentially, during colonization, we people in the Third World and South imagined, were actually in their anti-colonial struggle, trying to imagine a future, a good future, because they attributed all their problems to colonization.